in the building, you know, shirt sleeves on, you know. I thought that, I said, how is this going to work? But this is going to be some structure, you know, this massive glass. Is the glass ever going to break? Is it going to leak? I can't believe what I'm looking at, but, you know, this is his idea. It's a cool-looking picture anyway. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm double-checking right now. I got the email from you, but I think there's no attachments, Paul, in what I got.
Okay. Well, you know, I put it actually right on the email. It should have, you know, as you read the text, it should have came up. That's the way I sent it. Maybe I should have, maybe your system isn't compatible with mine. Instead of just sending the pictures directly on the page itself, I should send that as an attachment.
No, I can't.
But, you know, no big deal. What I saw, what it sent was a picture of the three new participants on the International Space Station that went up a couple of days ago. The crew that's up there now, along with them, nine people inside the Zesda module. The Zesda module is the big module for the Russians. They always take that picture. Every time a new crew comes up, they all go in, and they all take a picture with you in the Zesda module. Later on, they all go into their respective locations. They usually pass through the Zarya functioning cargo block module through the adapter. And then they call it PMA, pressure mating adapter 1. And then they float into the Unity module, and from there they go into Discovery, and eventually they make a way to their particular bedroom. You got nine people up there. Where are they all going to sleep? I know there's four that could sleep in the Unity. And there's two in Zesda, where the Russians are. What are they going to do with these other people? I'm going to have to check. They must have set up a couple of bedrooms for these people.
I just found out there's a funny different way I have to open up your email that you sent to me at 5:37 this afternoon. And I've now got five photographs. First photograph is three astronauts all holding hands, two guys and a girl, and a picture inside of the... looks like the International Space Station. Looks like 9 people. Then this rocket with a tower alongside of it. So I got a total of five pictures. Are those the ones you're talking about, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, they had a nine people, too. And the nine people, you have four Americans, three Russians, one guy from Italy. That's Louis Pomacano. He's the guy that had the problem with the EVA with the water in his helmet, you know, about 2013, where he almost drowned. And, I mean, that's the type of guys these are. You know, you think when he got back home, he would have said, no more of that. Here he is back up again. He's going to be doing more spacewalks. Luca Pomatano, I think his name is. He's from Italy. And then you have the new people. You've got the the girl, the Russian, and the guy from the United Arab Emirates. So it's three of them that went up the other day. Now three are going to come back. 7 days from now, and then you're going to have your standard six people back on the space station. That's a normal number, six people. In the future, once Dragon is going and Boeing Starliner is running, You're going to have a steady 7 people on board the space station on a regular basis. And then the one with the star, the starship is, you know, it's got a moon backdrop. So that one I like. And then the other one where it's a dark looking starship, that was the actual picture from last night. It looked like a drone took the picture. Musk was down at the very bottom. That's 164 feet high. And Musk was down at the very bottom with, you know, with a lot of people down below. And they had a big television set up. And he was showing the progress of SpaceX through the years. How they got from point A to point B. And then all the new stuff that they have, how they're going to dock in space and, you know, tail to tail and refuel and on and on about his stainless steel, 301 stainless steel. I thought it was an interesting thing he said about that. You know, nobody makes rockets out of stainless steel anymore. He does. Everybody else makes it out of carbon composites or aluminum. He's making his out of stainless steel, 301 stainless steel, all welded together. And he said something interesting. When it gets cold at these cryogenic temperatures, the stainless steel actually gets stronger. That I'd like to ask Dr. Roy about. Back to you, Dick.
With 9 astronauts on board, do they really have enough Soyuz spacecrafts to bring them all back down if there was a sudden emergency?
Oh, yeah, that's flight rules, you know. Flight rules are you have to have a seat for everybody. Not only do you have to have a spacecraft, your seat has to be designed for your body. So if you're a big guy or a little guy, you have your own seat. You have your own spacecraft that you're going to. If there's a fire on a space station, then you have to abandon ship. So the amount of ports that are on the space station, you have 4 on the American side. Let's call it the American and the European Space Station side. And you have 4 on that side. And, you know, 2 are equipped for crews to dock, and then the other 2 are equipped for cargo. Cargo, you can bring in these, you know, 50-inch wide things. People, you can bring in whatever fits through a 1 meter hole, 39 inches roughly. That's for people. Well, the Russians have 4 docking ports as well. So we have 4, and they have 4. Therefore, they don't have any big cargo systems like we have, you know, for berthing. All 4 are the same, whether it's a progress ship for cargo or whether it's a crew coming up. Let me drop it. So you have the 4 ports. 3 of those ports, is one port on, up on top that's filled with spacecraft for people, and then there's one on the bottom that has spacecraft for people, and then there's one in the back. That's the one that's just docked now. It's docked right into the Zesta, the rear end of the Zesta. They have a docking port there as well, and then the other one is filled with the Progress vehicle. So all 4 are filled up. On the American side, we just have 1 right now. The cargo for the HTV-8, the one I talked about earlier, the HTV-8 cargo vehicle from Japan. So that's it. So everybody has to have a seat. That's why when recently they had to move from one location to the other location because they had a problem with one of the vehicles that were coming up. Instead of one commander, Russian commander, jumping into the Soyuz vehicle and backing out away from the space station and relocating to a different port, he had to take all his people with him. So all 3 people got in and went for a ride, because if he's going for a ride all by himself and he's relocating, that means those 2 people do not have a spacecraft now to get out on. So that's why they do things like that. It's happened quite a few times on the space station. Back to you, sir.
Picture number 4 that you mailed me, which I guess Elon supplied to you, you see his rocket taking off of the moon with the moon in the background. Those shadows on that moon look like the sun was at a 50-degree angle, 40-degree angle above the horizon. So he's got what looks like a colony down there of habitable structures on the surface of the moon with the sun shining down at a 40-degree angle above the horizon. That can't be. You might be able to put structures like that on the poles of the moon, but if you did it far away from the poles, where the temperature on the moon surface goes to plus 150 at high noon and minus 150 at nighttime, those structures on the surface of the moon would never tolerate those kind of temperature extremes, Paul. So I think he's overly optimistic on that picture. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, like any kind of something designed, I don't care if it's a house or a city or a roadway, right? It starts off with some architect view, you know? He's going to invent this whole setup, and I guess that's what this is. And before it goes any further, you know, he would send it down to all the draft people to draft things out. They're going to look at it. They're going to send it back to the engineer, and the engineer is going to say, we can't do this. It'll go back to the architect. He's going to have to change something with those shadows. And then it turns around, goes back, eventually down to the draftsman, and eventually to the guy in the field. In this case, I guess the astronauts in the field. And they'll have to interpret whatever the final design is and see where they could put all those launch pads. You see the launch pads all lined up. I don't know. It looked like two or three of them with starships already on the ground, and this one is in the process of either taking off or landing. You know, on the picture I sent you. Anybody that's listening to this, I'll put these pictures eventually on Dr. Roy's roy.ac2gs.com website next week after he's back. Back to you, Jeff.
Picture number three shows a rocket that looks like it's being suspended by a crane, and it looks like it's above the ground. Is that an artist's conception, or is that a real photograph? And you said that Musk and a whole lot of other people are down there on the ground around it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the reason I said that was a clear picture, daylight picture of what the starship looked like, but the other one was dark. You know, it was nighttime. Quite impressive to look at that, though. But I wanted to show you that. And that crane that they brought in was able to see what they built these. They built that starship, you know, from the bottom up, and they were making these 30-foot, let's call them rings, and they would prefab the rings, and then they would lift it up with a small crane, put one on top of the other until they got up as high as they did, you know, roughly half that height. And then the pointy part, the nose of the spacecraft was built separately, sitting next to it. This is all outdoors they did this. They welded the thing together, not inside of a building or anything. So then they took the nose that was constructed, and that's the one that's eventually going to hold all these people. The original reports were, what, 100 people, and they want to hold 40 people now, eventually to go to Mars. Well, that needed to be put up on top of the part that was there, you know, pretty much built with all the tanks and everything inside. So they had a crane come in, a specially built crane, just to lift that up, and that's what you're seeing there. They put that together, I think, only a couple of days ago, and that was completed, and then this way it was one big piece when Elon Musk was there to show off his new space vehicle. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, on that picture I see two canard veins up at the top, and I see these pair of wings down at the bottom. Why does he need such great big wing-like structures? Over to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I tried to explain that earlier, but he had a demonstration although I think the demonstration could have been a little bit better when he was describing it. But what happens is, you know, the space shuttle used to come in, you know, belly first, you know, and it's the same type of thing. this has got to come in belly first, you know, on a 60-degree angle, let's say, from the moon. And if not a very steep angle, it's going to be coming in very shallow. In fact, he plans on making maybe a complete orbit before he completes, before he starts to enter real atmosphere, to keep the heating of the stainless steel down to a lower temperature as possible. He's got on the bottom, on the windward side, he does have, he calls them glass tiles, this Piker thing, we call it Piker X, but he's got his own tiles that very similar to the idea of what the space shuttle tiles more like, but this is permanently bonded to the spacecraft. It's going to be reusable. So as it's coming in belly first, these big long wings, he originally had planned on three on the bottom. You see there's only two. Figured out it's coming in belly first, and that's going to be slowing itself down. That's what he meant by, it's similar to a skydiver coming in. These two big fat wings in the back are going to be slowing himself down. Now he's got gigantic motors, electric motors, controlling the movements of these things. So you did see these things moving in the animation. Let me drop it. This is what I was surprised at. He's using electric motors instead of hydraulic motors. So he's got these Tesla batteries, car batteries from the shop that he installed three of them into the Starship. And that's going to control the movements of the canards in the top and the bottom. The main thing is the bottom wings, to try to keep it, facing in one direction. He doesn't want to flip over, because the opposite side is going to be just stainless steel. He can't flip over because he doesn't have any heat tiles on that. Plus, he would lose his aerodynamics anyway. So then as that gets deeper into the air, the tail, he's got a design where the tail will start to come in first. The engines will start to fire, slow himself down, similar to what he does with the Falcon 9, and eventually come back and land roughly where he took off from. He's got a landing pad set up. Back to you, Dick.
Those two wings on the bottom, what percentage of them pivots, Paul? That's not clear from this very small picture I've got on my screen. And what are those black vertical objects near the base of the rocket? They look like they're 5 or 10 feet in diameter, look like they're 20 or 30 feet tall, and there's at least a pair of them I see on the bottom. Over to you, Paul, K2RIWI. I'm having trouble understanding this.
Yeah, he didn't show a good picture of what the legs are going to be looking like, but I believe you're looking at a couple of pairs of the legs. There's now going to be 6 legs instead of 3 legs. He originally planned it 3. Now he's going to have 6. That's actually what Jeff Bezos wants to do with his New Glenn space rocket. He planned on 6 legs as well. So maybe he thought that was a good idea. I don't know. He's got the 6 legs, and then he's got the 2 big wings to slow him down. And so those legs will eventually open up as it comes in for a landing, I think. That's pretty much the way he's got it.
Does it land tail first, or does it land like the shuttle land?
Tail first. No, it's same setup as the Falcon 9. Same thing, way the Falcon 9 comes down, tail first. Falcon 9 has 3 legs. This thing has 6.
So this enters the atmosphere with the 2 forward canards and the wings and their great big elevators at the back. Does some kind of flying around for a while, and eventually it turns itself around and lands tail first?
Yeah, well, it turns itself around, and then as it's coming down, you're going to have a burn, which is, they're going to light the engine to slow itself down even more, coming from probably, say, 50 miles up and down through the atmosphere. And then it'll shut off and it'll coast even further. And when he gets close to the landing, another rocket engine will go off and slow itself all the way down until it stops. And now, not only is he doing it on this, he's going to be doing the exact same, similar type of setup, except he's not going to be going as fast. He'll be going around 3,500 miles an hour with the booster. The booster comes down and lands tail first as well. So this is his ultimate goal, was to reuse everything, and that's the plan. There's no way he's going to use, you know, nothing's going to burn up there. This is all coming back. And everything, like you said, tail first, and not on a barge. I don't hear anything about barge with this. I think the cost of moving a massive spacecraft like the Super Heavy, or even this thing, maybe just, you know, out of the question with the barge. He wants to bring it all back to where it's going from.
Okay, with those wings, he does a whole lot of flying at high speed coming down. I guess near the end of that flight, he's in the vicinity of the landing pad. He then pulls it up into a vertical climb, and then starts using the rockets to back down. Wow! And he's got astronauts on board. And what happens if he gets a failure during that mission? What's the escape mechanism for the astronauts in that nose section now, Paul? Go ahead.
I don't think there's any. I think you're toast. He's got multiple engines, you know. He'll have, on a finished version, he'll have six engines as he comes down. Three are optimized for atmospheric use, and the other three are used for in space. You know, they call them vacuum engines. So, yeah, he's going to have... you're making it seem like he's going to be flying low into the atmosphere, you know, and using these wings to really, you know, change direction, thought facing up. He's going to be doing that pretty high up. He'll still be in thin atmosphere when he gets to that point. He described it like a skydiver coming in. You know, skydivers, you got your arms out and your legs. Your legs are like the big fins, and your arms are like the canards in the front. And you slow yourself down as much as you can. You know, when I say slow it down, you're going to slow that forward motion. You're coming in at 17,000 miles an hour to start. So you got to, and even faster if you're coming from the moon. And you got to start, you know, it's not the downward direction you're worried about. You want to try to de-accelerate in the forward direction. And once you can slow down enough that way, then you can turn your spaceship around. With the help of these wings. These wings are being controlled. They are being controlled by these motors on the inside. And they, you know, that's how they're doing it. And the motors are going to be running off electrical lithium-ion batteries.
If he starts coming in like a skydiver, flat to the atmosphere, so to speak, because those wings have so much more area than the two wings up front, that's going to automatically force the spacecraft to go nose first into the atmosphere. You can't fly that thing flat with those wings that big unless those wings pivot by a whole lot. What percentage of those wings pivot, Paul, K2RIW?
You can't tell from the animation. He's doing this in rarefied air, his atmosphere. So it's functional. He's trying to slow his forward motion down, and he's trying to come in as shallow as possible so he doesn't overheat the spacecraft. And then once that forward motion is slowed down enough, then how high, but, you know, you still might be, you know, 40 miles high, 35 miles high, and you turn. At that point, you have thrusters on the top of your spacecraft, which will be able to push the nose up, once you get into a dropping position, then you could ignite the engines like the Falcon 9 does. You know, that's what he does with the Falcon 9. He does a boost back with the Falcon 9. He'll stop that forward motion with, you know, going 4,000 miles an hour. And then he'll turn the spacecraft around fire the engines and, you know, boost back and until he's almost to the point where he could drop vertically, where that forward motion is stopped. That's his goal. And the same with the Starship.
Whenever you come back from the moon, you're coming back into Earth's gravity from a long distance away. And when you free fall that distance, you hit the atmosphere at 26,000 miles an hour. I don't know what Mach number that is, but it's a big number, Mach 25. And therefore, your skin that hits that air is going to be glowing. Stainless steel can't tolerate those temperatures. Where's the ablative heat shield that tolerates that 26,000 miles an hour of hitting the atmosphere, Paul?
Yeah, half the spacecraft, they call it the windward side of the spacecraft, not the leeward side, is all going to have this piker insulation. He's gonna go high in temperature, but like I said, he's coming in at very shallow, much more shallow than the shuttle did, and that will raise the temperature, but not high enough. Stainless steel, they said, holds temperature much better than aluminum does. Your melting temperature of stainless steel is a big difference between the two. You're still gonna go above melting temperature, you know, so you're still gonna need protection, but it's not as bad as aluminum. You know, I think if the shuttle was made of aluminum and the carbon broke off of the Columbia when it did, and you had a stainless steel skin, you might have had more of a chance. There's, you know, hundreds of degrees difference between stainless steel melting temperature and the aluminum, you know. And basically, you're going to, you know, he's running a spacecraft which has better thermal properties for coming through the atmosphere, and also for launch. You know, as your temperatures, or even in space, you know, as you're coming through, he's got these cryogenic temperatures still activated. When you cool 301 stainless steel down to cryogenic temperatures, the colder you get, the steel actually gets stronger instead of weaker.
That steel is going to go to a couple of thousand degrees Fahrenheit when it hits that atmosphere. I'm having trouble believing the steel will tolerate that, even though it's going to have these tiles on it. Wow. And the leading edge of those wings are going to get those temperatures. Are those tiles on the wings also in the back?
He's probably got the bottom. He said on the front. Front, in other words, as it comes in, that whole front and the whole front of the spacecraft is going to have these tiles. And he doesn't need them on the back because the temperature's not going to get that high. Stainless steel. If you had aluminum on the back, yeah, you'd have to do a little something better on the back. But because of the stainless steel, it's going to be more tolerable, you know. I'm sure he's gonna test all the stuff. He's not gonna put a crew on there first. He wants to launch this within a couple of months to 12 and a half miles, and then by next year he plans on putting one in orbit and seeing how it does. Coming back, he plans on burning it up, I think, because he won't have enough fuel to make it back to a landing. He wants to see. Probably, like the temperatures and everything you're talking about as a test. But by that time, he'll have another one of these things built. You know, he built this quick. I mean, we're looking at 6 months he put this thing together.
And as it's configured in that picture, that forward capsule could contain how many astronauts, Paul?
Well, he didn't say last night, but I've read a lot about it over the years. His initial plan was for 100 people to be able to go to Mars at a time. And that, inside of a couple of years, that changed to 40 people. But if you read people's stories on the internet, which you can't trust, you know, some of them are still using that 100 number because they never changed. But the last I heard from Elon Musk was 40, and that was probably about 2 years ago. And he was going to have all kinds of provisions. You're able to bring was it? I'm trying to think how many tons. I think it was 200 tons of something to either to the moon or Mars. He figures there's not much difference. So I think like 200 tons of, so that, you know, if each person required a ton of stuff to go with them, that would be 20 people. My guess is 20 people.
Wow. And that ship is big enough for that. Hard to believe. Huh. When it comes to his moon mission or Mars mission, have people already signed up, Paul, and how many have signed up?
No, he's only got one guy right now for the moon mission. He wants to go around the moon and come back. About a year or two ago, he signed this guy up from Japan, billionaire. And he wants to bring 6 people with him. So, that, you know, after Starship is put together, probably 2022, 2023 or something, he's going to put this guy in there that's already put up some money. And he wants to bring 6 artists with him. I don't get it, but, you know, I guess he's going to bring a poet, a painter, or, I don't know. So that's the only mission that I know that somebody has put up any kind of money for a flight around the moon or to the moon. This guy just wants to go around the moon and come back.
And that person coming back from the moon is going to be hitting the atmosphere at 26,000 miles an hour. And that will be untested. To come back from Earth orbit, you hit at 17,000. You come back from the moon, you hit at 26,000. Without really sending something to the moon, I don't think there's any easy way he could get a ship in near-Earth atmosphere up to 26,000 in order to test that re-entry capability, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, maybe he'll just do that, you know, take an unmanned mission, launch this thing around the moon and send it back on, on its own, you know. I mean, the math might tell him it will work, but, you know, until somebody tests it, you know, I'm sure they'll do something like that before the fellow from Japan gets on board. And then going to Mars would be another story, you know. And they could slow themselves down with different engines. There's a we're going to talk about that. This Vasimir, they call it the Vasimir engine. You know, it's a variable specific impulse magna plasma rocket, they call it. It's being built by a company, Ad Astra. Not the movie. There's a movie that just came out called exact same name, Ad Astra. I don't know how they get away with it, but it's the same name as this rocket company. And this is like a super duper ion engine. Instead of the ion engines that they use today, this one's like, you know, 100 times more powerful. That's what they're going to need to, you know, accelerate their trips to the Mars and to slow themselves down to some degree before they get here to help with the re-entry. That's going to be, that's an engine under development, but, you know, they've never put it on, into space yet. This guy's looking to do it.
Do those rear wings have heat protection tiles on the pole? If not, how in the world are they going to survive re-entry?
I didn't see any. This is all preliminary. In fact, I didn't see any heat shield. You know, I saw his own little documentary of a heat shield, but the vehicle itself, I didn't see anything yet. So maybe that's not applied yet. But yeah, they're going to have to do something like that. Everything on that windward side, you know, from the nose all the way to the tail, will have to have heat protection. Because the whole thing is stainless steel. But there's this guy, he's an astronaut, well, retired astronaut. Chang Diaz, his name is. He's flown on, like, the most space shuttles ever, I think, like 7 space shuttle missions. And he's one of these astrophysicist type, you know, he was into the tokamak fusion reactor stuff, you know, before he became an astronaut. But he's got this company, Ad Astra, which is developing this Vasimir ion engine. And he tested it out at 100 kilowatts. For hours on end, it's one of these things that can go, for years if you want. You could fire it up, and you could have a lot more power than these little ion engines that push out the amount of thrust as a couple of pieces of paper. This is gonna, you'd be able to push out the amount of thrust like a book, which would be a lot for, space travel. It's under development at Astra. It's by the way, I got to see that movie. I put that on my list. Maybe I'll just have to wait until it comes out on TV. But that's supposed to be a pretty good movie. Back to you, Dick.
Of that picture with the vertical spaceship on the pad with the crane alongside, I think you said there's six main engines on that thing. I think three of those engines, air-breathing engines, Paul. And if they are air-breathing engines, are the air-breathing engines used both on launch and on reentry? K2IW?
No, just like the Falcon 9, they run the Merlin engines. You have Merlin engine, nine of them that launch from Earth, and then that separates, and then you have the exact same engine on the second stage, exact same engine. It's another Merlin D engine. What they call it, a Merlin vac. It operates in a vacuum. You get a lot more thrust out of it. And the reason for it is you have a bigger cone, a bigger bell exhaust. If you look at the difference, it's like a 3-to-1 ratio. So that's what I mean by vacuum. So the bottom of this engine is going to, the bottom of this Starship is going to have six engines. Right now, it's only going to have three. It's for the test, like up to 12 and a half miles, it's just going to run three engines. But let's say that passes and they run, a couple more tests and they're happy with it. Eventually, they're going to put six engines on it. Three will be the same as what they have. They're not lined up linear. They're lined up, they're in a triangular fashion. And every one of them is gimbaled, every one of them. So those three, and then there'll be three more, and they will be, they're called Raptor engines on the new spacecraft. They're called Raptor engines. 440,000 pounds of thrust each, so you have three atmospheric operating type of engines, and then when you get to space, you'll be able to use the other three, the vacuum ones, which actually put out more thrust than the 440,000 pounds of thrust. So, for test purposes, you just got the three, and then operational, he wants to run six. And that's just, on the spaceship itself. Remember the booster. The booster's going to put the spaceship, the whole thing, into orbit. And that one's going to have like 30 of these engines. And they'll be all, there won't be any vacuum engines on that. Because that will just go into, that'll bring up to 3,500 miles an hour. It'll bring up to around 70 miles, and then that will eventually come back. That will never go into orbit, but the spaceship will.
So what we're looking at here is the second stage, if I understand correctly. There will be a great big booster with 36 engines below it on takeoff. So this second stage has six engines. Three are vacuum engines and three are non-vacuum engines. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, just think of them as all the same engines. The only reason they call them vacuum engines is because the one is optimized for, optimized to operate in space. And because it's optimized, you're actually going to get more power in space. They're the exact same engines. The primary difference is the different cone that's sticking out of it. Much bigger on in vacuum. When you watch a SpaceX launch, you'll see the nine engines launch off, and then that first stage separates and comes back and lands on land or lands on the ship, the barge, and then that second stage is always going. You'll always see it. You'll have a picture of it, and you'll see that it's glowing. That's the Merlin vacuum engine. It's going to be the same thing with this, except it's going to have three, and they're going to be Raptor engines. And the three that, the other three that, you know, the second stage will be using it, which is this vehicle that he highlighted last night, will have the three. So, total of six. And you can see, I have another picture, maybe I'll send that one to you at the bottom of it. You can see the cones, the exhaust. There's six of them. You see three are definitely bigger than the other ones. Back to you, sir.
What's the fuel in this thing, Paul? Is it cryogenic methane, or is it kerosene? And I heard you earlier, I think you talked about cooling the kerosene. Why would you cool the kerosene? Over to you, Paul.
They get the kerosene right now. They bring it down to as low a temperature as possible. It densifies that, too. I don't know the numbers that they get it down to, but, you know, even so, it's liquid. You can cool it down, and it does shrink to some degree. So, and then the main thing is oxygen. The oxygen, they liquefy that, of course, but they bring the temperature so cold on that that it almost freezes. You know, so that's what the, you know, RP1 or kerosene and liquid oxygen. But on this is liquid methane, CH4. So you got CH4 and O2. So liquid methane and O2 are your fuels. And when you're burning methane, you need a lot more oxygen than you definitely burn kerosene. So the tanks actually have to be bigger. It's a 4-to-1 ratio for, you know, for oxygen to methane. You know, so CH4 needs more oxygen to burn compared to the kerosene, which is roughly a little over 2-to-1. Back to you, sir.
Okay, now, which stages use what kind of fuel? Over to you, Paul.
Oh, they were all going to use the same in this case. Yeah, it's a little different than what the new blend is going to be like. The blend is by Blue Origin. Blue Origin's got a similar big rocket, and not as big, but that's going to be liquid methane as well, liquid oxygen. And their second stage is going to be liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. This guy's using all the same for the super heavy, which is the first stage with the 30-some-odd Raptor engines. CH4, O2, and the same for the Starship, which is going to have six engines, three of which will be vacuum optimized. So they'll all be CH4 and O2.
I think Saturn V used kerosene. What's the advantage of methane over kerosene, Paul?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is methane is much cheaper. If you go out in the middle of Texas, they're burning off tons of methane that they can't even sell. It's just burning up millions of gallons a day. You know, they're just burning the stuff up. So they can't get rid of it fast enough. So it's much less expensive. And number two, it's a cleaner burn. So for reusability, you're going to get less carbon buildup in all these turbo pumps and all the combustion chambers and all, you know, any of these rocket parts. So it's a much cleaner burn. Less of a chance of things fouling up. Much better for reusability. So I think that's your primary reason. The third reason is, if you make it to Mars, you could take the gas through a saboteur equipment that they're going to be sending to Mars, so you're going to be able to separate the carbon dioxide that's on Mars and mix it with hydrogen and this and that. And next thing you know, you're going to get methane. So you'll be able to refuel your rocket on Mars. You don't have to worry about, you know, where you're going to get, you know, where you're going to get kerosene on Mars. So you can make methane, but you can't get the kerosene back either.
Yeah, it sounds real simple to take the atmosphere out of Mars and make methane out of it. It's going to take a tremendous amount of energy to do that process. Where has all that energy come from, Paul?
First of all, I don't know how much energy you know, you're going to need, but you're going to need a lot of energy for everything. I don't see going to Mars without nuclear fission modules doing something. I really don't. You know, you're not going to be able to do this all with solar energy. You know, even if you have fuel cell systems, which involves like a hydrogen mixed with oxygen type of thing, you're still going to have to come up with the chemical for that from somewhere. You know, you're going to dig the ice out of Mars now and separate that, I guess you could, and then create water electrolysis. With the electrolysis, you're going to need something to separate the water to get hydrogen and oxygen to use for fuel cells. You have a lot of problems they're going to have to work out. And Elon Musk's idea is, you know, I'll build a big ship to go to the new world, but, you know, it's up to you guys to figure out, you know, how you're going to grow the trees on Mars to make your home.
All those wells in Texas that are burning off a whole lot of methane, that's too bad that can't be used similar to natural gas in private homes. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's all part of this fracking system. You know, they just burn it up. I mean, they just had a... I don't know if I watched a documentary, or maybe it was on 60 Minutes a week or so ago. Just saw it recently. And I forget how many cubic feet of methane that burn. I mean, it just goes day and night. They say people can't even live there. You know, there's a smell in the air. It's not healthy. I mean, you know, it's just miles, I think, bigger than the state of New Jersey or something. It's just area, you know, the area of all these towers in the air with, you know, flames flying through the air, burning all the stuff off that they can't save. So I think it's virtually free. You know, if you could just capture it and bring it over to your rocket, you're good to go.
Isn't methane a greenhouse gas? And isn't even burned methane a greenhouse gas? You're putting carbon into the atmosphere. You're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. All of that methane being burned, isn't somebody complaining about that as far as global warming and atmosphere and weather change is concerned?
Yeah, I'll complain about it. But down in Texas, they don't care, I guess. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure of the physics behind it, but, you know, I would imagine that this methane is going to come out of the ground whether you burn it or not. The methane going up into the air can't be good. Yeah, I think that's going to all contribute to global warming. But are we creating that, or would it come out of the ground and just go up without them doing it? They said it's from the fracking process, so I'm not sure. I'd have to look further into that. What do you do to stop the fracking process, stop the, you know, developing the oil? You know, always develop nuclear power. I'm in favor of that. Back to you, Dick.
Well, each of our nuclear power stations is not supposed to have an accident for 100 years, and we burned into those 100 years a couple of times already with Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, and there was another one in Louisiana, I think, a runaway. So nuclear sounds good on paper. It's not that easy, Paul. We are getting closer to being energy independent, though. I hear those words coming out every so often. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of solar panels and wind panels, you know, the windmills. Sounds good to me. Anything to, you know, to cut back on it. You know, like they said, you know, where the other countries have got to chip in too. They're all doing something. It's a global problem, you know. I wonder what happened with Saudi Arabia when it blew up all those tanks, You know, they burnt for days on end, and I don't know how many millions of gallons they burnt up. Didn't all that stuff get into the atmosphere? Would that contribute tremendously to the global warming problem? Did you see that?
Yeah, I haven't heard very much of the specifics of it, but didn't take them very long to put out all those fires. Is that true?
I don't know. I thought it was burning for quite a while. Tank after tank after tank. It didn't look good from what I saw. But maybe you're right. Maybe they were able to somehow shut valves down and stop it. They said 5% of the oil supply of the world was stopped because of it. Maybe 5% didn't burn up. Maybe production stopped because they couldn't, you know, they had to shut everything down, I guess. So at the time was starting to get late. Back to you, there.
Have you used up the subject you wanted to talk about, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. The Vassar engine was one. Only because of that movie. I got to see that movie. They said it's supposed to be the most realistic space movie going. You know, you don't want to go to a movie like that with me because, you know, I'll question everything I see on that screen, you know. But they said it's supposed to be very realistic. We'll see. Ad Astra. I don't know. It could be a bomb for all I know. I have no idea. I'm going to wait for it to come out on DVD or, you know, one of those. So, I got pretty much nothing else. Maybe we'll close down, Dick. I got about 7 minutes left. Or somebody has a question or a comment. Back to you, sir.
What do we know about the movie Ad Astra? What's it about? What happens, Paul? Go ahead.
All I remember is the name. I thought it was very odd that they took the name from this guy's company, and this guy's not happy. You know, I haven't heard a comment or anything, but... And maybe it's a good advertisement for them. Ad Astra is the name of the company that's building the Vassar ion engine. But it means to the stars. And as far as I know, you know, I just saw the clip, you know. Or it could be the world's worst movie. And when you see these trailers, you know, it looks like the best thing ever. But I don't know, it looked like they showed a couple of rovers on the moon and flying through the, I mean, it looked like they're going 100 miles an hour through on the moon. I'll have to see it. I have no comment right now. But, you know, I'll watch anything like that.
Is it in the theaters now or soon to be?
As of the 20th, they said. So we're today's the 29th, so it's been out for 9 days.
So we don't know anybody who has seen it yet.
Not yet. But I don't know. We'll have to see. It's supposed to, you know, somebody's trying to figure something out. And don't tell anybody the ending, one of those. But I'm sure it's probably pretty good. You know, back to you.
Anybody famous in it that we know?
Pitt. I'm terrible with all these actors, but he's in it. And then there's another guy, the older guy. I'm just bad with these guys' names. He's been around forever. So, I recognize two people. That's not saying much.
Okay. If you've run out of subjects, we should end a little bit early, Paul. Back to you for a choice.
Yeah, that's pretty much it for me. I'll say 73, and we'll be glad to see Dr. Roy show up next week, and we'll be back to normal. And I keep records of these numbers. I'm up to 265 for this net. And Roy's going to stay steady at 93. TechNet itself is 1,965. Give one or two. Give or take one or two. We're not that exact. But that's it. We'll be back next week. And we'll turn it back to you, Dick, for a final. And go Limelock. Go TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
Go
KB2GXM.
Go ahead, Rich.
Is Rich N2EO still on the net?
I doubt it.
All right, I have a link to a video that he should watch about the SDR Play radio, which he wants to use. I guess I will bring it up next week.
You could email him.
Do you have his email?
No, I don't, but I think it's one of the common ones.
All right, I'll look on QRZ or I'll bring it up next week. Thank you. WB2GXM out.
Okay. Bye-bye, you all. I must have slipped somewhere here, Paul, because I thought the net you're giving me now is number 364. It sounds like you said 265.
365. 365.
Okay. Bye-bye, you all. See you next week. KQRIW clear.
That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Morning, the time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.